This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 5, 2003, from the studios of WBAI in New York City. I'm Deepa Fernandes. Members of Iraq's security forces held large demonstrations today in Baghdad. After yesterday's deadly bomb blast in the Philippines that killed 17, Filipinos fear the US will allege links to Al-Qaeda and send more troops. And the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court advises Governor Ed Rendell to halt all executions until the state can administer the death sentence fairly, saying the system is racist. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Turkish army broke its silence today when General Hulmi Özkök declared he supported allowing U.S. forces to attack Iraq from Turkish soil. Aaron Glantz reports from Ankara, Turkey.
General Özkök's comments are likely to weigh heavily on parliamentarians. The army has overthrown the civilian government three times in the last 40 years, most recently in 1980. The Turkish parliament could consider a new motion on the war as early as next week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
A bus packed with students was bombed in the northern Israeli city of Haifa today, killing 15 and wounding 40 more. Eris Mackler reports from Jerusalem.
Bus number 37 was ripped apart by a massive explosion in the center of the port city of Haifa Wednesday, going up in flames, strewing wreckage and body parts in a wide radius. The passengers were mainly students from nearby Haifa University. The bomber displayed an unusual and deadly coolness, traveling for a few stops, waiting for the bus to fill up, and moving to where it was most crowded before detonating his massive 50-kilogram suitcase bomb. As with all such terrible incidents, also tales of heroism. An Israeli Arab was driving behind the bus, and despite being injured in the explosion himself, ran into the burning vehicle to save injured passengers. No Palestinian group has claimed responsibility for the attack, and Israel is cautious about any reprisals, saying it's aware of regional sensitivities ahead of a possible conflict in Iraq. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
Senior Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said Iraq is showing more signs of disarmament as they have destroyed another 9 outlawed missiles. Yet he warned that it might not be possible to verify that Iraqi officials have destroyed biological agents by digging in the area they said the agents have been buried. Bush administration officials reiterated their statements. Secretary of State Colin Powell said Iraq is not totally disarming in earnest. Sending a massive diplomatic blow to the United States at a meeting in Paris, officials from France, Russia, and Germany hinted they would likely veto any United Nations measure to strike against Iraq now. And immigrants from African nations are protesting being systematically deported en masse from the European Union. Nick Champeau has the story from Paris.
Anti-racist organizations state that the Ivorians were returned to a highly unstable country, and human rights groups condemn the use of charters, which they say transforms the expulsions into secret operations without any methods of control. Control is needed, it seems, as in December and January, two illegal immigrants died while being repatriated. They were bailed on the plane and were allegedly choked by the police officers who were trying to calm them down. The Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, announced that European member states were planning to organize more joint mass expulsions. Nick Champeau, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Across the United States today, more than 300 high schools and colleges participated in a National Day of Protest against the Bush administration's threatened military action in Iraq. With their message of books, not bombs, students called for an increase in education spending at a time when everything but the U.S. military budget is steadily being cut. In Bush's home state of Texas, hundreds of students from around Houston gathered at Rice University to show their support for peace. KPFT's Renee Feltz has more.
Students at Rice University walked out of classes today to join a citywide anti-war protest in the center of the school's campus. Several professors ended their lessons early so students could attend the demonstration. School staff and student leaders joined professors and members of the school's poetry slam team in speaking out against the war.
If you want to go to war, then go to war, but stop sending my friends to die in your place. Stop curtailing my freedoms and passing legislation allowing you to read my emails and track my credit card purchases.
If the Bush administration moves forward with its war plans, the invasion could cost more than three times what the federal government spends on K-12 education. The call for a student strike has been taken up by students in Canada, Australia, and throughout Europe. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz in Houston, Texas.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Members of Iraq's security forces held large demonstrations today in Baghdad. This comes as Iraq has begun increasing the military and police presence on the streets of the capital city. From Baghdad, Jeremy Scahill reports.
Over the past several years, it's been rare to see a significant military presence on the streets of Baghdad. But over the last several days, Iraq has begun deploying additional security forces at intersections and key roads throughout the city. In some locations, Toyota trucks can be clearly seen with large machine gun turrets on the back. Some observers say the deployments are training drills, but others say it's the beginning stages of Baghdad implementing martial law when a U.S. attack begins. Already in areas of Baghdad, trenches have been dug, and today the Iraqi Interior Ministry held large demonstrations aimed at sending a message that the country will strongly resist any attempted invasion. Meanwhile, Iraqis huddled around TV sets today in cafes and homes throughout the capital city to watch the emergency summit of the Organization of the Islamic Conference. Some 56 countries are gathering in Doha, Qatar, to discuss ways to avert a U.S.-led war. Though it's not being reported here in Iraq by the local media, one of the issues being discussed at the conference is the call initiated by the United Arab Emirates calling on Saddam Hussein to step down. Today, Iraq's Foreign Minister Najib Sabri said any calls for stepping down should be directed at George W. Bush, who Sabri said was causing America to be hated around the world. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
The gathering of the 57-member organization of the Islamic Conference was the third high-level gathering in the Middle East this week, aimed at trying to prevent a war, and the second to be marred by bitter and insulting exchanges. Arab and Islamic nations are divided on whether war can be averted while Saddam Hussein remains in power. Rafael Kraft reports from Amman, Jordan.
Shut up, you minion, you U.S. agent, you monkey. You're addressing Iraq. You're insolent. You're a traitor to the Islamic nation, shouted Iraq's Vice President Izzat Ibrahim at a Kuwaiti diplomat this afternoon during the emergency summit of the Organization of the Islamic Conference held in Qatar's capital Doha today. Qatar's Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani tried and managed to shut him up. Hassan Choubaki, a journalist for the Jordanian Daily Al Rai, monitored the summit this afternoon from his office.
I watch the words. It is not political words. It is just like a Bedouin's problem. It's shamed for the Arabic street and for the general opinion. It is not a political behavior.
The aim of the emergency one-day gathering, to which only a quarter of the 57 members of the Islamic organization send their heads of state, was to unite the voice of the world's 1 billion Muslims against a possible U.S.-led war against Iraq. As Jamal Al-Tahat, commentator in the Arab press, explains, the performance of the Arab leaders today wasn't different from the one at the Arab League summit held last Saturday in Sharm el-Sheikh.
It's a very precious opportunity for people to see their leaders performing in the way they performed, actually. And on the other side, these two conferences proved that these systems of these huge and grand summits, they are not practical and they will not be very useful in the coming future.
While several Gulf states and OIC members like Turkey host U.S. forces and bases to be used in an invasion of Iraq, there was no fresh initiative from the summit to resolve the ambivalent stance by Iraq's Muslim neighbors.
هي القادرة على التصدي للواقع الذي نحن بصدده بنجاح
In a communique at the conference read by Qatar's Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, Islamic countries would not participate in any military action which targets the security and territorial integrity of Iraq or any Muslim country, and would reject any attack on Iraq. This conclusion is an attempt to satisfy both Iraq and countries like Kuwait and Qatar, which host US forces. In a speech with reporters, Qatar's Sheikh admitted the 57 members of the Islamic organization didn't have any power of decision on the Iraq issue, but said they could provide weight to a peaceful solution. While the members of the Islamic organization await the next report by Chief UN Weapon Inspector Hans Blix, another 60,000 more US troops were deployed yesterday in the region. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Amman.
After yesterday's deadly bomb blast at a crowded Philippines airport killed 17 and injured over 150, so far no one has claimed responsibility. The military has blamed Moro Islamic Liberation Front rebels. Yesterday's attack comes as resentment among Filipinos is growing after the US announcement last month to send US troops to the Philippines to disrupt and defeat Abu Sayyaf, a rebel group the US alleges is linked to Al-Qaeda. Filipinos accuse the US, their former colonial rulers, of snatching any intelligence reports as conclusive evidence to prove that there is a link between these groups, Al-Qaeda, and now even Iraq. Bino Alex reports from the Philippine capital, Manila.
Yesterday's airport bombing that killed 17 relived the dangers that Filipinos face in their day-to-day lives. 30 years ago, a battle for separate autonomous Muslim state began in the southern Philippines. The group the military blames for yesterday's deadly attack dates back to 14th century when the Moros converted to Islam, resisting the Philippines' Catholic rulers. Originally established as the Moro National Liberation Front, the group turned more militant when broke away and formed what is today the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or MILF. The US says it has strong evidence to prove that MILF and another bandit group, Abu Sayyaf, have links to Osama bin Laden. In mid-February, the government troops seized materials that they claim to be evidence to these links. Military intelligence said this evidence points to suspected benefactors of the group in the Middle East, parts of Africa, and in Pakistan. However, these claims have proved far from satisfactory, and in further attempts to convince the Filipinos, journalists like David Whelan believes the US State Department is using news organizations to suit their own interest.
American, they use Maria Ressa of CNN. They brought her back to the States or something and gave her a course and showed her all of these connections supposedly of Al-Qaeda with the Muslim rebels, so that every time she got on television here in Asia, she made it look like they were still receiving almost daily paychecks from Al-Qaeda. Part of that, I think, is because CNN was used from the State Department. She was confronted by the Muslims here who said that she was very anti-Muslim in her news broadcasting, and they asked her to tone it down, and she simply refused.
Intelligence officials in Manila say they have uncovered another link between an Iraqi diplomat and the Abu Sayyaf group. Late last month, a television channel reportedly quoted one of the Abu Sayyaf leaders saying Iraq instead paid them to kill American servicemen who are likely to arrive in Philippines to train their armed forces. Iraq, however, had denied these allegations. But for the US, this was enough proof of Iraqi sponsorship of foreign terrorism, which also included funding to Al-Qaeda. Filipinos have reacted angrily to deployment of US special operation troops in combat operations. Last year, the US troops started advising the armed forces of the Philippines in counter-terrorism tactics to trap Abu Sayyaf, who still has some hostages in its custody. But the Philippine constitution forbids foreign troops from engaging in an offensive while on Philippine territory. They are not even allowed to fire their weapons except in self-defense. Froilan says the US troops deployment will be suicidal for any government in power.
That would be a direct violation of the Philippine constitution, which forbids foreign troops to stage or conduct combat operations within the country. Any Philippine government official who agrees on that would be subject himself to an impeachment, removal from office. This we have a Philippine law. This is a country, a sovereign country. Everybody should follow that. Even the United States should respect the laws of a sovereign country.
Retaliatory attacks like yesterday's bombing have become a routine feature in Philippines now. Observers like Whelan says the US is up to much more than just training the Philippines armed forces.
But most people feel that the U.S. are trying to build a base here so that they can jump off into Indonesia, but they deny it. And so it's just one person's speculation against another person's denial.
A spokesman for President Bush said the United States will walk shoulder to shoulder to make certain that those responsible are brought to justice. Filipinos hope this doesn't mean more U.S. troops on their soil. From Philippines, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
The Supreme Court today upheld long sentences meted out under the tough three strikes offender law, which allows for prison terms of up to 25 years to be granted to a small-time thief on the third offence, which may have been as simple as shoplifting golf clubs. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that this did not constitute cruel and unusual punishment. This is yesterday afternoon a 550-page report released by the Committee of Racial and Gender Bias in the Criminal Justice System, a study commissioned by the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, advised Democratic Governor Ed Rendell and the legislature to halt all executions until the state can administer the death sentence fairly. Governor Rendell opposes a moratorium on the death penalty and is a former prosecutor known for his work against Mumia Abu-Jamal. Dante Toza reports from Philadelphia.
The report calls on Pennsylvania Democratic Governor Ed Rendell to order a moratorium which shall not be lifted until, quote, policy and procedures intended to ensure that the death penalty is administered fairly and impartially are implemented, unquote. There's no immediate response from the governor's office to FSRN. The report looked at the circumstances of 245 inmates currently on death row in Pennsylvania. That makes the state's death row fourth largest in the country. 68% of the inmates on death row are minorities, although the state's minority population accounts for only 11%. Pennsylvania is second only to Louisiana in the percentage of African Americans on death row. Peggy Sims, an African American who is a community organizer for Family and Friends chapter of death row inmates.
I thought it was a long time coming, and that it's something that we in Philadelphia truly, truly need. And this has hit the black community very hard. It's something that we're trying to get help on, this issue, for a long time.
Researchers of the report also found, quote, African-American defendants were sentenced to death at a significantly higher rate than similarly situated non-African-Americans, unquote. Also that one-third of African-Americans on death row in Philadelphia County received a death sentence would receive a life sentence if they were not African-American.
None of the information and none of the recommendations and none of the data that they've cited is necessarily new information to anyone who has looked closely or even remotely at the application of capital punishment in Pennsylvania. In fact, these are things that many groups have been saying for a long time. Nine of the largest municipal governments in Pennsylvania have called on the state to suspend executions. The Pennsylvania Bar Association and the Philadelphia Bar Association both have recommended moratorium. Hundreds of groups have called on it.
Jeff Garris, the executive director of Pennsylvania Abolitionists United Against Death Penalty.
What is new, though, is that this is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's committee making its recommendation. Back during his campaign for governor, Ed Rendell stated that he supported the death penalty. He stated that while he did not feel there was a reason to have a moratorium on executions, that he would certainly support one if evidence came forward suggesting that there was a problem.
This is a national trend. Last year, both Illinois and Maryland have moratoriums, but Maryland's new governor lifted as he took office in the beginning of this year. This report has immense pressure on Governor Rendell to act.
I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Ed Rendell, as governor now, to claim that there's no compelling reason to suspend executions. We are really looking at this point in time for leadership coming from both the governor and the legislature on this issue. This is not an issue of whether or not one fundamentally supports or opposes the death penalty. At this point, based on this committee's recommendation, it's a matter of does one support or oppose justice and fairness in the ways that our laws are carried out. I think ultimately what it comes down to, though, is what are Pennsylvanians going to require of their governor and of the legislature?
As for the next step, the report is now being reviewed by a committee that is going to consider action as a result of the findings. The committee is chaired by Rendell's wife, a U.S. Court of Appeals judge. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Dante Toza.
As the state of Pennsylvania awaits a decision from Governor Rendell to halt all executions until issues of racism and capital punishment are fully investigated, we go to our own correspondent on death row in Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal, as he reminds us of the ever-present police brutality faced by African Americans in the United States.
There was something unutterably terrible about the death of a child. The universe seems to pitch and turn and fall into itself when something so unnatural as a child leaves the realm of the living. On Christmas Eve 2002, it happened. Indeed, more than that happened. A 12-year-old boy was shot into eternity on that date. Shot by a cop who would later claim that the boy was running from a suspected stolen car with his hands in his pockets. Putting aside for a minute the absurdity of the image of one running with hands in one's pockets, the state police would later claim that the boy, Michael Ellaby, was shot because his partner had fallen and he thought that he was shot. The city of Uniontown is a fair-sized town, roughly 150,000 people. It's the county seat of Fayette County in southwestern Pennsylvania. Has a black population roughly equal to the percentage of blacks in the nation's population. But population, standing alone, means little if that population doesn't have real representation and, more importantly, power. There was a coroner's inquest into the case, but it was composed of an all-white jury. Despite the eyewitness testimony of a young white boy who was looking at the shooting from his window, the jury and the judge running the show declined to charge the cops with anything. The witness recalled that he saw the two troopers shooting at the boy. A few days later, the local DA would announce that she would not charge them with anything. In the wintry weather of February, some 300 Uniontowners and others gathered at the Fayette County Courthouse to protest the tragic killing and to demand justice. Michael Hickenbottom, the boy's father, spoke simply and eloquently to the gathering, quote, "I'd like to thank particularly God who blessed each and every one of us to be here today. The Pennsylvania State Police shot and killed my son, and now they're trying to cover it up. I know there's love in this world when I look out and see all of you here today," unquote. Families filed a federal lawsuit charging civil rights violations and wrongful death. Some of the marchers expressed anger that nationally known black leaders did not join them in their protest against the Fayette County criminal justice system. Many of the big names were invited, none showed. Pictures of the child show a boy with a sweet half-smile, a knowing glint in his eye, and a sense of the immortality that all children seem to delude themselves with. Once again, the police have set forth the Amadou Diallo defense, the "I thought my partner was hit" bit. They're allowed the old "I was just doing my job" excuse, and are thus able to quite literally get away with the murder of a child. A child is dead, shot in the back by a minion of the state. A black child is dead, a hole burrowed into his heart. Once again, a boy does not live to become a teenager. A child is gone. And according to the law, no one is to be charged for it. A black boy is dead again. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
A court in India today ordered the excavation of a holy site disputed between Hindus and Muslims. The site in the northern Indian city of Ayodhya houses the remains of a 16th century mosque destroyed by a Hindu mob 10 years ago. This decision comes in a crucial election year where several states are either at the polls or headed there, and India's Hindu extremist lobby seems determined to ratchet up communal tensions. Tomorrow, India's Supreme Court is to rule whether religious activities can take place around the disputed site. It had earlier banned such activities to avoid raising tensions between Hindus and Muslims. Tensions are rising on other fronts as well, as the opposition accused the BJP-led government of fomenting divisive communal forces. The government decision to include a portrait of the famous founding member of the Hindu extreme right and one of the accused in the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi in the Hall of Fame for Independence has also triggered vociferous protests. Sputnik Kalambi reports.
The judiciary should expedite its work and give an early verdict. It is also necessary for political parties, religious leaders and eminent social personalities to promote an atmosphere of mutual understanding, goodwill and accommodation.
If President Abdul Kalam thought the BJP was listening, he was wrong. With elections underway or due in several states, the BJP and its hardline Hindu allies are once again fomenting communal tensions. Addressing thousands of Hindu activists and so-called holy men in Delhi last week, the firebrand leader of the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, or World Hindu Council, threatened 1,000 Ayodhyas if they were not allowed to start constructing a temple on the disputed site, off bounds until the Supreme Court issues a ruling. The stirring of the communal cauldron is gaining deadly momentum. Three people killed in neighboring Madhya Pradesh when police tried to prevent Hindu extremists from storming an 11th century monument revered by Hindus and Muslims alike. Attacks against Christian priests justified by so-called holy men who obtained promises of a cleanup of the holy but polluted river Ganga after threatening to forego their ritual dips. An admirer of Hitler, who pledged allegiance to the British and was one of the co-accused in the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, eulogized as an independence hero. PM Bhargava, scientist and civil society activist based in Hyderabad.
Government, in the heart of their heart, supports the VHP RSS demand. Let's accept this, whatever the Prime Minister says. They support it, sometimes overtly, sometimes covertly. I do not understand why Supreme Court has not given a decision. It's such an important issue, why should it be kept pending for so long?
To kill or not to kill cows comes to center stage, as the Prime Minister brushes aside issues of starvation and drought and vows to die rather than eat beef. Brush aside the Supreme Court and hand over the entire disputed Ayodhya site to the VHP, echoes his deputy, one of the accused in the 1992 demolition of the mosque. Adding insult to injury, the BJP party president asked the Muslims to gift the site of the demolished mosque to the Hindus in the name of brotherhood and national integration. Sabir Khan, theatre activist from Jaipur, Rajasthan, says the entire political debate has been hijacked by the Hindu right.
Those who rule know full well that the day the people start demanding the right to food and other basic necessities, they won't be able to hold on to power. So to divert their attention, they highlight this. And this is the irony that no one seems to understand. Because if there are riots, it's the poor who will be hit first. And the educated ruling class is very cleverly using such attacks to sidetrack people in order to remain in power.
The BJP has evidently taken its election victory in Gujarat to heart, and the Hindu right is pulling out the stops to replicate Gujarat in other states. In neighboring Rajasthan, a communally sensitive state where elections are due later this year, the Hindu extremist RSS is distributing tridents to poor Hindus and even those outside the pale of Hinduism in the name of countering Muslim jihadism.
Gujarat was a laboratory. They want to make Rajasthan another Gujarat. Their strategy is to mobilize Rajasthan's tribal people and enroll them in the RSS. They're training them and giving them weapons, encouraging them to use their traditional weapons too.
The opposition is visible, but only just. True, they have raised ruckus in parliament and staged walkouts, but apart from the left parties, the mainstream opposition is also bathing in what is known as the soft saffron approach. Election campaigns launched in temples, photo ops with religious leaders, pledges to ban cow slaughter. Hindutva, or the BJP's brand of political Hinduism, fears Pratap Mehta of Delhi's JNU University, has become bigger than the BJP itself.
I think there are two fundamental things at stake here. One is that no political party is confident enough to stake an election campaign on issues of governance. All of them have enough skeletons in their closet. And so this is all a charade that we all want to talk about governance. Nobody really wants to talk about it. And the second thing, which is more fundamental, is as a society, we are losing a sense of what it means to be a free society.
India once again seems headed for troubled times. And a grim warning comes from former Army Chief Shankar Roy Chowdhury, who described the VHP leader as the Hitler of Hindutva. Praveen Togadia and people like him need to be arrested under the anti-terrorism legislation that the government has used so readily, he said, if the country is not to slide into another spiral of violence. This is Sputnik Kilambi reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.